said, by the time modern science got around to even asking the right questions, the entire ways of life of native people had all but vanished. The field of anthropology barely existed before the year 1900, and accounts of native populations before then often come from the perspectives of the conquerors or missionaries, all of whom had vested interests in diminishing the accomplishments of the people that they studied. The historical record only goes back so far, and attempting to gaze deeper into our evolutionary past to a time before writing is limited by what has been preserved by chance in the archaeological record. To get an idea of what we can know about how humans engaged with their environment in the deepest recesses of history, I called up Mark Kissel, a paleoanthropology postdoc at the University of Notre Dame. Mark also happened to be my roommate back when I enrolled in a PhD program in cultural anthropology in Wisconsin, and has since become my go-to source for everything on human evolution. His research focuses on the origins of symbolic thought, the earliest evidence of violence between early humans, and the emergence and prominence of Neanderthals. I ask him what challenges our ancestors faced and whether there was any evidence of physical abilities they might have had that we have since lost. He gives me the scholarly equivalent of a shrug. "They were almost certainly more physically fit than us," he begins, "but the record isn't perfect. We don't even have a complete Neanderthal skeleton, just pieces from a lot of skeletons to sort of make up a Franken-Neanderthal for us to understand their biology. The softer parts of their bodies, anything that might decompose over tens of thousands of years, has pretty much been lost." Since we first started digging up their abnormally heavy bones in a limestone quarry in Belgium in 1829, Neanderthals have sparked heated debates about their place in human evolution. One thing is clear, however. Neanderthals are the closest species to humans that has ever existed on Earth. Even so, they still technically sit on a different twig of our evolutionary tree. They appear in the fossil record as far back as 300,000 years and seem to have mysteriously gone extinct about 40,000 years ago. Some theorize that their decline happened in part because of the rise of our own species, either through warfare or just competition over resources. Either way, there was surely some contact between us and the Neanderthals, and it appears that the two species mixed and reproduced together. If you're of Asian or European descent, you likely have between 1 and 4% of Neanderthal DNA in your own personal genome. Nevertheless, knowledge of early human and Neanderthal biology is pretty much limited to what we can understand from the bits of their bone fragments that we've dug up. There is one thing that we do know, however. The invention of technology as a rule seems to correlate with a general weakening of the raw physicality and resilience of our species. It was much colder then, and during the time that we didn't have fire, they would mostly have had to eat raw meat, Kissel says. This almost certainly meant that they had some pretty impressive gut bacteria. If not for our resilient guts, humans would never have been able to survive on uncooked meat without risking serious illness. Indeed, the fossil record tells us that some of the most obvious skeletal changes occurred in conjunction with cooked food. Richard Wrangham, a biological anthropologist at Harvard, argues that the human jaw started shrinking once we learned how to control fire. Since cooking softens meat and kills potentially harmful bacteria, we no longer needed the pronounced mouths and powerful forward-jutting jaws of our more ape-like ancestors. Cooking also made vegetables and meat more nutritious. Instead of spending more of our time chewing plant fibers to break down resilient cellulose, we could outsource that effort to fire, which radically increased our ability to extract calories. Wrangham writes in his book, Catching Fire, that the invention of cooking by our early ancestors was literally what made us human and sparked the evolution of Homo erectus 1.8 million years ago. Homo erectus was different than the great apes that preceded it. Homo erectus walked upright on 2 feet and, because digestion takes less time when food is cooked, has a smaller gut than most apes. Over the next million years or so, Homo erectus experienced a gentle progression into the more refined human form we now enjoy. Presumably because Homo erectus didn't have to spend so much time chewing, it could do other things that led to evolutionary pressure that increased reliance on technical skill. Therefore, brain size increased. At some point, Homo erectus also lost its body hair, seemingly because he could use fire to keep himself warm at night. Rangam's analysis breaks new scientific ground precisely because he shows that technology has had a profound effect on the human form. In fact, its effect is so strong that it is almost impossible to separate human evolution from cultural and technological changes. To put it another way, the body you have now would not have been possible had we not invented fire. But that doesn't mean the transitions were always smooth, or for that matter, fast. At various points, as technology and biology altered course together, when the pace of change was too rapid, we began to suffer from evolutionary mismatches between our outdated biology and the world we were quickly inventing. The most classic example of an evolutionary mismatch, and an easy one to locate in the fossil record, is the position of our teeth. As the human mouth shrank over time, the number of teeth remained constant. Today, as we grow older, wisdom teeth poke out of our gums and shunt the other teeth out of position. This requires surgery or intensive orthodontics to correct. As such, humans are victims of their own success. Before cooking, humans spent a lot of their day chewing on food to break it down, and the process moved teeth around in the jaw and put them into their correct positions. But since fire made food softer, human jaws didn't have to chew as much, and, absent the constant pressure, teeth could shift out of position. Mark Kissel says that he knows of no other animal, certainly none of our ancestors, that has the same problem. Indeed, cooking also seems to have changed the quality of our teeth, not just their position. As an archaeologist, Kissel has examined hundreds of hominid teeth from both hunter-gatherer and agricultural societies. The latter have more cavities. The mouths that we have now are in much worse repair than those of early humans. Dietary changes, most menacingly sugars, make us good candidates for tooth decay. No Neanderthal or Homo erectus ever had cause to visit a dentist. Understanding changes in soft tissue that give rise to evolutionary mismatches is far less straightforward. Barring an amazing stroke of luck, like the discovery of a flash-frozen Neanderthal body in permafrost, there is no definitive way to tell how our muscles, brains, fats, and organs have changed over time. Anthropologists and biologists are stuck making educated guesses about the vast majority of our early biology. Neanderthals thrived across Europe during an ice age in which glaciers extended much farther south from where they are now. Located far from our arboreal ape ancestors, Neanderthals created a sophisticated culture, buried their dead, and used ornamental beads to decorate their clothing and jewelry. Though less durable artifacts haven't survived in the record, most anthropologists believe that at the height of their technological proficiency, Neanderthals would have used heavy furs and built semi-permanent dwellings that they could heat with fire. Those technological advantages, however, don't explain how the species persisted for more than 200,000 years in such a cold environment. In 2002, Theodore Stegman, a professor of anthropology at Tulane University in New Orleans, was contemplating his forthcoming retirement when he penned an article in the Journal of Human Biology that proposed an entirely new way to think about Neanderthal survival. Stegman reasoned that Neanderthals must have relied on a variety of biological strategies to survive in the cold, and he set out to examine the scientific literature to find even the most obscure anatomical research on modern humans. He was looking for clues in human physiology that might help him determine what the meat of a Neanderthal body might have been made up of. By measuring the skeletal structure of various specimens, he estimated the approximate muscle mass of the Neanderthal species. Stegman noted that their shorter limbs and greater general body mass would have insulated their core from harsh weather. This observation was hardly revolutionary, and would have gone unnoticed if he hadn't also suggested that Neanderthals used brown adipose tissue, BAT, colloquially known as brown fat, to keep themselves warm. Brown fat is a fundamental tissue in mammals that, at the time, was mostly understood as something that rodents used to help heat themselves during hibernation. The spongy, fatty tissue looks a lot like ordinary white fat that most mammals use to store excess caloric energy. But where white fat can serve as an insulator, brown fat has an active role to burn white fat in order to generate body heat. It's the only mammalian tissue whose sole purpose is to make heat, or, in scientific terms, thermogenesis. In humans, however, BAT was only considered important in newborns. The very first challenge that a human faces once it is born is the constant fight to keep a stable body temperature. With a relatively high ratio of surface area to body mass, babies lose heat much faster than adults. This is why many premature babies spend their first weeks in incubators. The easiest way for an adult to rapidly increase their core temperature is through shivering. The activity of muscles generates a moderate amount of heat as a byproduct of movement. Fresh from the womb, infants lack significant musculature and can't shiver themselves warm. Instead, they are usually born with a layer of chubby rolls of insulating white fat. When their core temperature begins to drop, BAT turns on, it sucks white fat from their system and releases a cascade of heat energy. Once the infant becomes a child and its muscles begin to tone up, the white baby fat disappears along with the brown adipose tissue. By the time they're adults, most humans have very little BAT in their system. What does remain is often just a few teaspoons worth of the tissue along their spine and shoulders. Most doctors figured that BAT was simply irrelevant for adults. In fact, most adults have so little BAT that anatomists didn't even know it existed in us until the 1970s. However, Stegman argued that Neanderthals were able to deploy the same heating strategies as human infants, and he scanned obscure literature on human physiology to prove it. He cited a Finnish study from 1981 in which an anatomist compared autopsies of two groups of manual laborers. The workers came from two different groups, people who worked indoors throughout the year and others who toiled outdoors. Finnish winters are famously brutal and closely mimic the conditions that Neanderthals would have faced throughout the winter. The study compared BAT concentrations in the two sets of laborers and found that the ones who spent most of their time out of doors had significantly higher deposits of it. They had so much of it, in fact, that proportionally it resembled the levels found in wild mammals. The sole exception was a single worker who died during the summer. Stegman extrapolated from this that BAT levels vary with the seasons, and that if we regularly expose ourselves to the environment, humans would build up deposits of BAT in cold weather and then shed them when it gets warmer. Stegman realized that humans in industrial countries generally lacked the conditions that would spark the body to start building BAT. It's not that the levels of BAT naturally decline as humans get older, it's just that the body learns that it doesn't need to invest energy into building BAT when it lives in a perpetual summer-like condition indoors. Despite some of their technological achievements, Neanderthals were still subject to the seasons, and it would have made a lot of sense, if they were anything like humans, that the near constant exposure to the cold would have built up their levels of BAT in a similar way. Like a lot of groundbreaking science, Stegman's study was too far ahead of its time, and so it went mostly unnoticed by the academic community. This was at least in part because measuring BAT levels in live humans is an incredibly difficult task, one that wasn't even really possible when Stegman was writing. Even so, Stegman wasn't the first person to try to decipher the secrets of body heat. Anthropologists started conducting extensive surveys on cold adaptation on indigenous people around the world, beginning in the 1930s. Back then, the procedures were often rudimentary and often involved a sunburned researcher in a pith helmet convincing some unsuspecting tribesmen to wear a rectal thermometer while standing out in the cold or jumping into an ice pool of water. One can only imagine the pantomime involved in such a transaction. However, it was all in the name of science, and whatever the interpersonal interactions, researchers found a surprising array of biological strategies that native people deployed to stay warm. Above the Arctic Circle in the Norwegian territory of Lapland, one scientist found that the local reindeer herders had an incredibly strong vasoconstriction response to the cold, while at the same time they exhibited a pronounced drop in their core temperatures when they slept out in the snow at night. The Laps, it seemed, had discovered a way to simply not be bothered too much by getting cold, and had a much higher threshold before succumbing to hypothermia. But the strategy for surviving the Arctic climate was found not to be the same across all polar-dwelling populations. Inuit subjects who lived in northern Canada showed significant heat loss when given the same test, leading researchers to suspect that they were instead able to passively increase their metabolism. Inuit were also able to keep their hands warm when immersed in cold water, which means they had a blunted vasoconstriction response. This adaptation strategy would have meant that their bodies intentionally sacrificed some of their core temperature in order to have better dexterity with their hands. An anthropologist named H.T. Hamill, who studied Aborigines of the Central Australian Desert in the 1950s, observed that even though the tribesmen wore no clothing, they still slept outside throughout the winter when the temperature dropped to just below freezing at night. They slept on bare ground with only a screen of bushes to protect them from the howling winds. While they were asleep, Hamill tested the Aborigines' skin temperature and found them cold to the touch compared with the Western researchers who were studying them. This meant that the Aborigines not only had intense vasoconstriction, but their bodies somehow and mysteriously also experienced less heat loss than the European control group. Meanwhile, in Africa, Kalahari Bushmen in strikingly similar conditions neither shivered nor showed any signs of vasoconstriction, meaning they kept a normal skin temperature all night long. Studies of the Inuit, Laps, Kalahara, and Aboriginals revealed that the human body isn't limited to a single strategy to deal with the environment, but can pull from an array of solutions to extreme weather. While certain anthropologists would have been overjoyed to spend the entirety of their careers prodding and poking indigenous peoples around the world for the treasure trove of data that they represented, the golden era of biological measurement died up by the 1960s. Whether by conquest or simple lure of Western convenience, by then there were already too few untouched populations in the world to gain reliable data on what a wild human biology might look like. Lacking PET-CT scans, it was also impossible to determine the exact causes of increased metabolic activity in native people when they did find it. In broad strokes, however, thermogenic research has showed four main strategies that the body can use to resist the cold. Humans can increase their metabolic rate by shivering. They can warm through some passive metabolic mechanism, or they can shunt blood to their core by closing off veins in their extremities. Lastly, as in most cases of people who live in colder climates, the human body can also accumulate higher levels of ordinary white fat that acts as insulation that stems heat loss in the first place. Anthropologists credited the different strategies to genetic adaptations that evolve from people reproducing in diverse environments. It wasn't necessarily a sign of evolutionary abilities shared among all humans. However, by 2009, Stegman's hypothesis about brown fat was about to find an unlikely champion when new science had the potential to turn the entire field of human thermogenesis on its head. By then, PET-CT scans were becoming a regular addition to cancer centers around the United States and Europe. However, oncologists were beset by an unforeseen technical problem. The scans are a sort of nuclear imaging tests that are sensitive to metabolic activity. To take one, doctors inject patients with a radioactive dye that circulates throughout the body and then gets taken up by particularly active cells, something that can be useful to identify the early stages of cancer. In almost real time, the scanner maps out where the dye ends up. However, when looking for cancer indications, about 7% of PET scans returned blobby images of cancerous-looking areas around the shoulders and thorax. But when the doctors performed biopsies on the danger spots, they never found what they were looking for. So a Harvard researcher named Aaron Sipes looked at 3,640 different scans to figure out what the blobs really were. After comparing images with obscure textbooks on human anatomy, he discovered that the blobs mapped perfectly over the areas that an anatomist back in 1972 identified as inactive brown fat deposits. Sipes deduced that the very examination rooms where the PET-CT scans happened were ideal for activating BAT. They were abnormally cold, and patients wore only thin hospital gowns when they were in the confines of the machine. Under these conditions, BAT was simply doing its job to keep people warm, sucking up fats and sugars from the bloodstream and producing enough heat to light up the PET-CT scan readouts. More important, the discovery showed that BAT wasn't a vestigial tissue at all, but that even adult humans might reap the benefits from its presence. And thus, BAT might not only help explain the mysteries of how Neanderthals survived through Ice Age winters, but also how modern humans could use it to get through their own winters as well. Oncologists now note that PET-CT scans taken in winter months have more instances of BAT than in the summer, suggesting that it comes and goes with the seasons. At this point, it's worthwhile to mention another story about first contact between Westerners and an indigenous group. In December 1620, a group of religious outcasts from Europe landed on a foreboding spit of land on the coast of what is now Massachusetts, with the intention of setting up a colony. The settlers arrived in three rickety sailing ships and disembarked in the middle of a harsh New England winter. The colonists built a crude settlement and shivered unhappily in their drafty huts, unsure if they would be able to make it through to the spring. They were alone for months until a tall, long-haired Indian walked into their camp on a windy March day wearing only a fringed loincloth. He greeted them in English with the words, "Welcome, welcome, Englishmen." While the story of how Samoset knew any English at all before any Europeans had settled in North America is interesting, spoiler alert, he learned it from fishermen who had come to North America to hunt for cod, what is perhaps even more mind-boggling and relevant to the topic at hand was his outfit. Being nearly naked in the Cape Cod winter is, to most people's minds, crazy. And the first thing the pilgrims did was offer him a coat. He took it with a shrug. Who wouldn't want to be warmer in the winter? However, after Samoset introduced the pilgrims to the local Wampanoag tribe, it turned out that the same basic garb was standard throughout the entire region. Their secret didn't rely solely on their genetics. Contemporary accounts by colonists stated that the local tribes relied on conditioning to make their children more robust. Every winter, they placed their infants and children in the snow for a few minutes every day before bringing them back inside their houses. Repeated exposure helped condition the children to become more comfortable in environments that would make the typical colonist want to die. Today, the state seal of Massachusetts depicts an Algonquin native in a bare-bones winter outfit, an image that has no doubt stuck in the minds of the pilgrims as they considered how strange the land was in which they had chosen to live. The Wampanoag seemed to understand intuitively that resistance to the elements wasn't an innate power, Instead, they recognized that their bodies already had all the tools necessary to survive in the environment if they made a conscious effort to adapt. It's the same fundamental biology that probably allowed Neanderthals to survive, and there's no reason to think that these abilities are not shared by every person alive today. It's a lesson that hasn't been lost on Ray Kranze, a former NASA scientist living in suburban Alabama. He spent 15 years supervising experiments at the Marshall Space Flight Center, but his career took a turn once he decided to develop a scientific way to shed weight that wasn't focused around counting calories. Standing 5'9" tall and weighing 209 pounds, he wanted to trim down to a fighting weight of 180. But in the process of investigating his own metabolism, he ended up developing a theory that cut harshly against the grain of how most of us live in the modern world. Every human alive today lives in a cocoon of consistency, an eternal summer. We're overlit, overfed, and understimulated. And in terms of how long we've been on Earth, that's all new, he says to me while summer is settling in Alabama. We're missing out on what he calls metabolic winter, a time when the body adjusts to discomfort and scarcity between times of plenty. As he writes in his Opus article on the subject, our 7-million-year evolutionary path was dominated by two seasonal challenges, calorie scarcity and mild cold stress. In the last 0.9" of our evolutionary path, we solved both. The inevitable result of losing seasonal variation is obesity and chronic disease. As proof, he doesn't only point to the population of his home state, which ranks at number 5 of the most obese states in the nation, but also to the fact that our pets are fat, too. The only two animals in the world that suffer from chronic obesity are humans and the pets we keep at home, he says. There's a connection. The key to fixing the problem, according to Kranze, is to artificially reintroduce seasons back into our lives. Drawing on the growing literature on brown fat and metabolic analysis, he prescribed himself daily hour-long walks in sub-60-degree temperatures along with moderate exercise and calorie restriction. In the course of just 6 months, from June to November, he dropped almost 40 pounds. Kranze's research isn't just about losing weight, though. He's trying to correct what biological anthropologists call evolutionary mismatch diseases, or, in layman's terms, what happens to the body when the pace of technology overshadows our fundamental biology. By looking backward at where we came from and the conditions that our ancestors inhabited, we might be able to create more adaptive conditions to flourish ourselves. What's more, because humans are inherently adaptable, even moderate changes in the way we approach the environment should trigger our own evolutionary programming. Just about anyone should experience rapid results. And whether that means simply becoming more robust in life in general, or unlocking untapped mechanisms in my own body, it is a challenge that I figure I can take on myself. Chapter 3: Measuring the Impossible. Rob Pickles has small white patches in his mouse brown hair and the athletically trim body of a guy who spends 16 hours a week biking up and down the mountainous roads around Boulder, Colorado. As the lead exercise physiologist at the Boulder Center for Sports Medicine, he helps train and analyze world-class athletes as well as patients who are fresh out of the cardiac unit at the nearby hospital. A few weeks before our meeting, I'd sent him a long and scattered email about the feats that Wim Hof seemed to be able to accomplish. I regaled him with the story of my dramatic weight loss in Poland and how I ended up at the top of a mountain in little more than my skivvies. I ended the message with a small request. Would he be willing to assess my own physiology as I undertook Hof's method for 6 months? The subject is intrinsically interesting to Pickles, as he always is looking for new ways to give athletes an edge in competition. His own history with hacking the body goes back to a time when he attended Ithaca College in upstate New York as one of the school's top 400-meter hurdlers. At the time, he was studying human physiology, with his eye on eventually taking graduate courses in sports medicine. One day, his professor mentioned a metabolic process called the bicarbonate buffer system that regulates the amount of carbon dioxide and hydrogen in the bloodstream. This complex system dictates that when the body works harder, acidity builds in the muscles. We experience this as fatigue. Pickers figured that if he could tweak the equation between exertion and the bicarbonate that buffers acidity, he could improve his performance in the races that he was competing in. Loading his body with baking soda, i.e. sodium bicarbonate, was an easy way to do this. The only problem, as he saw it, was that he'd need a lot of baking soda to make it work, almost 5 heaping teaspoons worth. That is enough to give someone a long and unpredictable and explosive case of diarrhea, which he considered an acceptable trade-off. When we finally meet in his office, I ask him if he thought his experiments with baking soda were worthwhile. "Well, it might have just shaved 5/10 of a second off my race time, but in an event that lasts less than a minute, that's the difference between first and last place," he replies. Pickles never lost a race in his entire college career. That is the sort of experimental attitude that I want to see in anyone who plans to run me on a treadmill until I almost pass out. We start our testing sessions in the summer of 2015, 2.5 years after I initially met Wim Hof. During the intervening years, I'd moved to Colorado from California and spent most of that time in different desk chairs researching and writing a book on the sometimes fatal side effects of intensive meditation. Now I am ready to investigate the other side of the meditation equation. I plan to dedicate myself to at least 6 months of Hof's training regimen in the hope that I might see some stark changes in my own biology. Before I start in earnest, I need to find a way to track how my own body changes over time. It's May, and the thunderstorms rolling up and down the front range of the Rocky Mountains aren't bringing any more snow. In a way, it's the perfect season to establish a baseline. Pickles agrees to design a test before I ramp up my training in the Wim Hof method to see how, or rather if, my body responds to a steady regimen of heavy breathing, meditation, and cold exposure. Pickles has seen crazy body hacks before, but I can tell that he is skeptical of the program that I am suggesting. Fortunately for me, Pickles isn't interested in my core temperature, which means I can forgo the rectal thermometer that he no doubt has stashed in a nearby supply closet. Instead, he wants to know how my body stores and uses energy. He is going to measure my metabolic rate by hooking me up to a plastic snorkel and pushing me hard on a treadmill until I can run no longer. There's part of me that wonders if perhaps he'll find something special, and that maybe, despite my infrequent exercise and desk jockeying nature, he might find that I have a hidden metabolic talent. When I drop the idea by him, he smiles and launches into a story about Evelyn Stevens, a Wall Street banker who worked 50-hour weeks with little more than an occasional jog to stay in shape. Stevens borrowed a friend's bike on a lark, donned some spandex, and toured with a local bike club one weekend. She was more surprised than they were when she left her fellow riders in the dust. A few years later, she won 2 stages of La Course, the Women's Tour de France, and currently holds the women's record for longest distance traveled in a single hour on a bike. As Pickles inches up the speed on the treadmill, I ask him if maybe I might hide the same sorts of talents as Stevens. He smiles like he gets that question a lot. "No," he says. "It's mostly about genetics." From the moment I walked into the offices in Boulder, he knew that I would never be world class. The dead giveaway, he says, is the one muscle in my body that I have always thought I had a legitimate reason to be proud of. After a splinter lodged in my heel as a kid, I've had a tendency to walk on my toes. My loping and oddly bouncing stride caused no shortage of middle school and high school teasing. But as a side effect, it also gave me abnormally large calf muscles. While they are by far the most toned part of my body, Pickles also tells me that they're a clear predictor that I just don't have what it takes to be an endurance athlete. It's like you're carrying two pendulums at the bottom of your legs, he says. You have to work harder than someone born with long, skinny legs. According to the guy who sees hundreds of top sportsmen in his office every year, world-class athletes are born, not made. Then he tries to ameliorate my dashed dreams by saying, well, look at it this way. If you won the lottery and wanted to train with us every day, we could probably make you relevant in an age-appropriate tier. Maybe not a professional tier, but definitely higher performance. So there it is. Apparently, I've got at least a little sliver of hope of being an Adonis after all. Consider me challenged. Pickles increases the speed on the treadmill a few notches, and I breathe heavily through the snorkel that connects to a pricey piece of hardware that measures a mix of carbon dioxide and oxygen coming out of my lungs. In the course of an hour, the treadmill test pushes me harder and harder, and every 4 minutes, Pickles pricks my finger with a lancet to draw blood to analyze for lactate content. 8 pricks later, and my finger looks like it just lost a fight in a local bar. It's bruised and bleeding, and I'm pressing on it with a swab of cotton to force a clot. I feel like I can taste blood in my mouth. Pickles has me rate my exertion at different stages of the process. I flash him moderate 5s and 6s out of 10 when he has me running up a steep hill at a 9-minute, 40-second mile pace. The data that he's reading, however, tells a different story. It says that I'm getting close to collapsing. My heart rate hits 182, and I'm breathing hard. He says that he wants me to reach a pace where I don't feel like I can run any faster. He presses a button on the computer that sends the treadmill up on an even steeper incline. It feels like he's planning to send me up one of the flat irons, the jagged mountain formations on Boulder's flank that demarcates the eastern edge of the Rocky Mountains. 3 minutes later, and I am tapped out. I groan through the snorkel and make a hollow echoing sound of a drowning Muppet. That's it. I'm done after 6 stages of incrementally harder exertion. My vision is blurry, and I want to put my head down on the rail of the treadmill to recover. Pickles examines several thousand data points that track my metabolic rate. Information splashes across 2 computer screens. There's a predictable curve upward that matches my exertion with every increase in speed. From the gases that left my lungs, he can tell that I burn mostly carbohydrates, indicating that I am definitely not a world-class endurance runner. Top athletes that compete in ultramarathons run mostly on slow-burning fat or a reliable source of energy. I'm the exact opposite. You could call me a carb monster, someone who seems to have granola bars in his bloodstream. It's the sort of cheap and easy metabolic activity indicative of a rather ordinary American diet. He almost chuckles when he tells me that I still have room for improvement. That said, it's not like I'm in bad shape. Since first meeting Wim Hof, I now work out 2 or 3 times a week, usually a 2 or 3 mile run around a lake. I might do an hour of lap swimming or take an occasional hike in the nearby mountains. I weigh about 190 pounds and have no serious underlying medical conditions other than occasional autoimmune mouth ulcers that I've had since I was a child. In other words, I'm pretty ordinary. In order for the experiment to work, I need to keep my routine roughly the same for the next 6 months. I'll keep up the same semi-regular exercise pattern for 2 or 3 workouts a week, and I'll eat the same sorts of foods. The only change I plan to make is to do the Wim Hof method as regularly as possible. Other than a few excursions that I have planned, everything else should be the same. So it's going to be an odd year. On one hand, I need to maintain a certain level of fitness so that I can actually measure the effects, if any, of the Wim Hof method. On the other hand, I'm going to explore different parts of the world where people use the environment to train their body. I want to slog in the mud with the Spartans and train with people crazy enough to surf monster waves. I even have plans for trying to persuade Hof to take me on one of his death-defying expeditions. The workout regime itself is relatively simple. Every morning before breakfast, I'm going to do breathing exercises, followed by breath-hold push-ups and a headstand. It's a truncated version of the method that Hoff recommends for a full hour a day. I choose this abridged routine because it is more manageable and easier to keep track of. When I do work out, I will be outside. For now, that means shirtless runs in the sweltering summer heat. But as the seasons gradually progress to fall and winter, there will be snow, wind, and hopefully a liberal buffeting of frost. Finally, I'll take cold showers every morning and, when possible, lie down in the snow like I'd learned to do in Poland. Altogether, the routine will add between 15 to 20 minutes of exercise to my day and should be easy enough to keep up with throughout the 6 months of the experiment. The key, I think, will be to keep exposing myself to temperature variation and getting comfortable with whatever weather is outside of my window. I want to be in touch with the seasons. My goal isn't to become the next champion ultramarathoner or to build muscle mass or even simply to lose weight. I want to see the effects of introducing variation into my environment and discover what happens when I try to take control of my body's autonomic processes. From my perspective, I'm mostly interested in your metabolism, Pickles tells me, noting that cold immersion might well change the way that my body utilizes fat. Then again, noting the pendulums that I have for legs and the carb-hungry tilt of my blood, he's not exactly holding his breath for a miracle. He asks me to report back in 6 months and says that he's looking forward to analyzing the results. Whatever the results, they'll offer a peek into a small, measurable slice of what the Wim Hof method might be able to accomplish. But there's another goal that will be harder to pin down even with a million data points: finding the critical fault line that helps crack open the space between the conscious mind and my unconscious physiology. If it exists, and if I'm able to tap into it, I expect I'll only be able to explain it once I feel it. I call it the wedge. Chapter 4. The Wedge. Warning: do not attempt any of these exercises while operating a car or heavy machinery. Doing so could cause an accident. The Front Range of Colorado is a string of mountains that marks the boundary of the Great Plains and the Rocky Mountains. East of here, the land slopes ever downward through prairie lands and bayou until it reaches the Mississippi River. To the west, spires of solid rock burst forth from the ground like a fortress, the result of millions of years of tectonic action. In 2015, the Front Range endured the most brutal winter that anyone could remember. Last summer, I'd rented a small ranch house in the city of Boulder. All was well. Then came winter. In a single morning, snow could pile up past my knees, making it hard to move more than a few feet outside of my door without first reaching for a shovel. For some, it was a bleak time of year. My small gray and black tabby cat abandoned hope of ever going outside again. In due time, though, spring settled upon the eastern slope, and with it, green grasses, thorny weeds, and wildflowers awoke from their dormancy. I take in a breath of that fresh spring air and suddenly realize that a certain species of birch tree that I happen to be allergic to has also emerged from its winter slumber. The invading pollen of this tree saturates the air and wages war on my sinuses. Unable to stem the flow of allergens, my itchy eyes begin to water, and I start to feel the irresistible urge to sneeze. So I let it go. And a second later, I sneeze again. And then again, until the explosions string together like an absurd form of Morse code. Sneezing is one of the body's many defensive responses against environmental threats. The neural circuitry between the nasal passage and the sneezing center in the brainstem is only a few inches long, and it is one of our most primal reflexive pathways. While sneezing can be pleasurable in small doses, indeed, the brain patterns of a sneeze recorded in an MRI machine resemble mini orgasms, an unremitting cascade of them is no fun. It doesn't take long for the sequence of ceaseless nasal explosions to turn irritating. So I decide to make it stop. And just like that, it does. Everyone has the ability to resist a sneeze, and while it might be hard to describe this with words, we all know how to do it. There is no exact method except to say that you tighten something in your mind, or maybe think non-sneeze-worthy thoughts. Somehow, you just will it to stop. In this moment of mental acrobats, you short-circuit an autonomic reflex and extend a measure of control over your body's programming. Of course, it's not foolproof. My allergies won't dissipate until the birch stops breeding. But recognizing this mental trick is the basic building block of taking control over your autonomic nervous system. Call it what you want: willpower, focus, or concentration. The mental state you go into while trying to delay a sneeze is a sort of wedge between the autonomic and somatic nervous systems, at the point where an environmental stimulus meets an innate response. It's the same wedge that a person uses to calm their nerves when standing in the snow, withstand shivering, hold their breath just a little bit longer, delay an orgasm, stop feeling ticklish, or hold back the flow of urine as they search for a bathroom. It seems like a small thing, but it's a window into the root of human power, and a place that, if exercised, can help unlock the body's hidden biology. Free divers who descend hundreds of feet below the surface of the ocean on a single breath sometimes call it the master switch. It's the point where the body meets the mind. Any pre-programmed physical response is potentially susceptible to the wedge as long as it has three characteristics. First, there needs to be a clearly identifiable external stimulus. Second, that stimulus must trigger a predictable autonomic biological response or reflex. Third, that physical response must elicit a feeling or sensation you can visualize or imagine independently of the external trigger. If the reflex has these characteristics, then using the wedge is as simple as setting up an environmental stimulus and then resisting the sensation that it triggers. Over time, it becomes easier to maintain the tension between the reflex and mental control. That said, not every reflex is an ideal candidate for training. Allergic responses might make for interesting test cases, but like many autonomic functions, they exist for a reason. Sneezing removes allergens from the body and is part of a preset program that has enabled the species to survive until today. Suppressing allergic reflexes could lead to all sorts of physical complications. The same goes for learning to hold your bladder at bay indefinitely. Sure, it's possible, but it's generally not a good idea. So, training starts with one of the most fundamental human reflexes, the urge to breathe. When the Buddha first taught meditation to his followers, he recommended that they start by watching their breath move in and out of their body. Breathwork is a staple of every yoga class, as students move their bodies in sync with their lungs. The Wim Hof method tasks students to hold their breath until they can't take it anymore, and then hold it just a little longer. This is the quickest and probably safest way to build your own wedge. The urge to gasp for air is not directly linked to the amount of oxygen in the bloodstream. That's because, for some reason that has been lost in a convoluted process of evolution, the body cannot sense oxygen, only its byproduct. Breathing is a two-part process: inhaling to bring oxygen into the lungs, and exhaling to expel carbon dioxide. When the brain senses too much CO2 in the bloodstream, the chest tightens, Vision blurs, and just about every muscle from the abdomen to the forehead clenches down hard. When we talk about this sensation, we usually say that we need to take a breath. However, on a physiological level, your body wants to expel CO2. It's sort of counterintuitive, but it's easy enough to test. Take a breath and hold it until you feel the urge to breathe. Then, release just a little bit of air. With less CO2 in your lungs, you will feel like you can hold your breath a little longer. That's because you've removed a potentially poisonous waste product from your body, and your nervous system has turned off the alarm bells. This basic gas exchange creates an opportunity to trick your nervous system into extending the amount of time that you can hold your breath, thus leading to the very first training technique to crack into your nervous system. But before you try any of the techniques in the coming pages, I need to offer you an obligatory disclaimer. The methods in this book carry some chance of injury, or even death. When you are choosing where to exercise, bear in mind the risk of briefly passing out and falling down. Before trying any of these exercises, you should get a doctor's approval. Getting started with basic breath holding. First, you will need to establish a baseline. Take a deep breath of air and time yourself with a stopwatch to see how long you can hold it. Most people can hold their breath for between 30 seconds and a minute without any training, but everyone's underlying physiology is a little bit different. While you're at it, also figure out how many push-ups you can do. When I first started, my arms began to buckle at around 20. Some people can only do 1 or 2. Whatever it is, write down your baseline so you can check back on it later. I should note that this is a variation on the Wim Hof method. It is an even more basic starting point than where he usually begins students with their training, and it is not precisely the one that he teaches in his courses. The first goal is to prepare your body by blowing CO2 out of your system. Start by sitting down on a couch or lying on the floor and taking 30 fast breaths. Each inhale should take about a second, but you should not force the exhale. Instead, let it flow out naturally. Your breath should sound like you're at the peak of a sprint, just a few seconds shy of having to slow down. It'll sound a little bit like this. Pretty soon, you're going to feel a little dizzy. This is normal. You might also feel tingling in your hands and feet. You might also feel cold or experience ringing in your ears. After about 30 breaths, you will have radically increased your oxygen saturation and cleared out most of the CO2 from your system. Now, finish the hyperventilating with a big gulp of air and hold it with a full chest. Time yourself to see how long it takes you to reach the point where you feel the need to gasp. Hold on as long as you can and clench the muscles in your chest, arms, and legs. You're probably making a pretty crazy face as you struggle against the urge to breathe. But when you can't stand it anymore, slowly let the air out of your lungs. This gives you a little boost of time before you take in any more air. The first time you try this probably won't produce any dramatic results. But you should find that you can hold your breath just a little bit longer than your baseline. You might also be surprised by how much physical effort breathing can be. The muscles around your diaphragm don't get a lot of strenuous, focused exercise, and it can take a little while to build them up. However, most people see dramatic improvement on how long they can hold their breath when they repeat the cycle of hyperventilation and breath holding for 3 or 4 cycles, for a total of about 10 to 12 minutes. And now comes the really cool part. Power push-ups. Start while lying with your back on the floor, then do one more cycle of about 40 breaths. Make the last 10 even a little faster. Then, take a giant breath in turn over, and immediately start doing push-ups while holding your breath. Try not to think about anything else other than the count. Or even better, think of nothing at all and have someone else count for you. You will feel that these were the easiest push-ups that you've ever done, and most likely will be able to smash through the push-up baseline that you set earlier. And you'll have done it without actually breathing. This will work with just about any sort of strength exercise, pull-ups, sit-ups, weights, leg lifts, or dips, if for some reason push-ups are not your thing. Of course, this is a pretty well-understood body hack. When you clear your lungs of CO2 and fill them up with air, there's enough stored oxygen to do a fair amount of physical exertion. However, your brain doesn't intrinsically know how you've changed the oxygen baseline to perform just a little bit better. Every time you do this, you effectively grow a slightly stronger wedge. Another, more powerful way to do this exercise is to start doing push-ups after an exhalation with empty lungs. When you feel the urge, take a breath and then continue until you are exhausted. These two methods work on slightly different parts of the nervous system. Both of these exercises work to find the meeting point between the body and the mind. Your brain has a subconscious map of what it thinks are your personal limits based on previous experiences. That map usually isn't well drawn for anyone who isn't the sort of athlete who constantly pushes themselves to the edge of their physical abilities. Since most people don't spend their days hyperventilating and holding their breath, their nervous system hasn't yet mapped out what is supposed to happen when they start. As it learns its new physical capabilities, new neural connections form and the brain creates a new set of guidelines. Congratulations! You are now training your brain to cede a little control to your conscious mind. There are a few known dangers to this sort of breathwork. It is perfectly normal to feel a little dizzy or for your hands and feet to get cold or tingle. Both are symptoms of increased circulation. The body will literally get high on excess oxygen, and the constant air circulation in the lungs tends to cool the blood down as well. It is much less common, but possible, to faint while doing controlled hyperventilation or during a breath hold. It is slightly more common to pass out during breath retentions when your lungs are full, while empty lung retentions will trigger the gasp reflex earlier. If you fall unconscious, your body will quickly reset to its autonomic programming and you'll wake up within a minute. In my experience, there is an increased chance of fainting while doing the exercises with full lungs, since the increased volume of air throws off the way my body detects CO2. Once, after reaching 80 push-ups, my arm collapsed and I banged my head on the wooden floor. The bump on my head was an indication that I'd found my limit. Some medical literature has also shown that it's possible to have a stroke or even a heart attack from hyperventilation. So, again, people with serious heart conditions or advanced circulatory problems should take extra care. While it would seem that this sort of breath practice would help people hold their breath underwater, indeed, some freedivers employ remarkably similar techniques, there is always the risk of pushing your limits too far and drowning. As previously noted, 308 freedivers have drowned while training and in competition between 2006 and 2011. There have been no fatalities among those practicing the Wim Hof breathing methods on dry land, as far as I am aware. The autonomic nervous system divides itself into two interrelated components. First is the sympathetic nervous system, which controls the so-called fight or flight response. If you were a car, the sympathetic system would be the gas pedal. It gives you short-term boosts in energy, activates the adrenal gland, and triggers dilation and vasoconstriction. The parasympathetic nervous system controls the opposite responses, sometimes called feed and breed actions. This is the equivalent of a car's brake pedal. The parasympathetic nerves act on digestion, salivation, sexual arousal, and tears. Both systems are involved in breathing, and the right techniques can help strengthen both sides of the nervous system, in the same way that someone at a gym can focus on particular muscle groups during exercise. Different breathing routines target different aspects of the nervous system. The basic breathing technique of holding your breath after hyperventilation acts mostly on the parasympathetic nerves. The sympathetic system only starts to kick in closer to the moment where you are struggling to stop yourself from gasping, and it is often best to train with breath-out breath holds. Breath-in holds are better for getting your absolute maximum number of push-ups or retention duration, but are less efficient at cracking into your nervous system. Power breathing. In order to prime your body to get to the gasp point earlier and thus build a stronger wedge and activate the sympathetic nervous system, start with the basic breathing method for approximately 30 quick, deep breaths. Keep your eyes closed and breathe hard enough that you begin to feel lightheaded. Now, instead of taking in a deep breath and holding it, let most of the air out of your lungs like you would at the end of a normal breath, by which I mean don't force it, and hold your breath with almost empty lungs. Your body will quickly deplete the oxygen stores available in the lungs and have to rely solely on what is available in the bloodstream. When you get close to needing to gasp, you can extend your limits in two ways. The first is the same as with basic breathing, slowly letting out what is left of the air in your lungs. The second method will become critical later for controlling vasoconstriction. It consists of a rolling set of muscle contractions that you start at your feet and sequentially tighten until you reach up to your head. The process is as follows. Relax your body and clench the muscles in your feet. Then clench your calves, then the thighs. Work the contractions up your body until every part of you is tight from the bottom to the top. Clench your stomach, your chest, fingers, biceps, and jaw. Tighten the muscles behind your ears and imagine all of this pressure that you've built up going to the top of your head like you were rolling out pizza dough. Whenever I do this, I end up making all sorts of grunting noises and squinting my face into awkward contortions. It feels like I'm going to pop, but I never have. Once you finally have to breathe, take in a half lungful of air and hold it for about 10 to 15 seconds. This is the recovery breath, and it feels awesome. Now start over from the beginning. Since your lungs start near empty, it won't be possible to hold your breath as long as with the basic breathing technique that we started with. Aim to increase the amount that you hold your breath with each repetition. When I do it, I start with a 1 minute hold, and then 2 minutes, then three. Even though everyone's physiology is different, Hoff says that at 3 minutes, you've cracked into your sympathetic nervous system. That's the physical side of the exercise, but there's a mental routine that you can do alongside the breathing. One of the goals of this practice is to shut down the higher cognitive functions so that you can communicate directly with the lower brain functions. The brain burns far more energy than any other part of the body. In a typical day, an adult male burns 2,200 calories. But the brain gobbles up 15 to 20% of that energy.